A63, number 11A.
We have been considering the days of creation, not just as a story, but as symbolizing a very fundamental law. Now, the question is, who has conceived of that law? We know that the days of creation come from the priestly document that must have been written around about 550 BC, probably in the Babylonian captivity, probably written by the priests, perhaps by the prophets, perhaps by the prophet schools. That we don't know. We only know that the priestly document is that document in the Bible that gives the teaching of the Bible of the Old Testament, and therefore is the most systematized teaching of all the documents compared with the Jehovistic document, the Elohistic document, the Deuteronomy, and so on. It is the priestly document that teaches systematically. You can also see that from the text itself. They used a very stereotyped language, you know, and God said, let there be, and then he did it, and then when he had done it, that was good, and the evening and the morning is the first day, and then that repeats itself in a stereotyped way, indicating really the exactness of presentation of a subject. Mrs. Eddy questions if the prophets of old knew the science of God, or if they only had the Spirit of God, and that the lack of the letter did not really hinder them from seeing the Spirit of this science. And this brings us naturally to a very important question. Is it necessary to understand and see the lawful development, the law, the ordered law, in the 7 days of creation? Or should we say, like perhaps the prophets of old, that they just were still enough and to listen to God and to get the Spirit of God? Now we know that there are always two ways for a higher understanding. The one is that of direct revelation, and the one is the way of science. But we also know that that direct way of revelation and inspiration is a way that is accessible only to a very few, perhaps one or two in a century, whereas the main body of humanity only knows the road of reason, so to say, to understand the subject, that the greatest part of humanity must take the way of science in order to understand. And this is so for Christian Science. Mrs. Eddy caught, naturally, the whole science through revelation. Nobody taught it to her. Not even the Bible taught her the revelation. She said that she received it direct, that she wrote under the divine dictates, and that only by searching the scriptures that she would find support in the Bible and verification of her revelation in the Bible. So she didn't get the revelation neither from the Bible nor from her own thinking, but a direct revelation from God. But seeing that the majority of humanity has not that transparency as she had, then therefore she could see that she said, but I must know the science of her discovery. and therefore she worked to discover the science that lay behind that revelation, because she would know that if she would find the science of that revelation, then that would be a possibility for each one to get hold of that revelation. So we cannot just say that because the very first ones who wrote the Days of Creation, that they caught it by revelation, that we also should get it just by simple revelation or inspiration. We must make use of the advances of science, and science has now shown us the road of reason and logic and of understanding so as to see the revelation of Christian Science. I say this because my next subject is a subject that was not on the assignment, but which I like to introduce to you, to show that actually it is so that if somebody is pure enough, transparent enough, that they always can catch the melody of a scientific law. Just as the prophets of old could catch it and write it down through the 7 days of creation, in that way there were here and there inspired people through the ages that also were somehow catching that tone. And those who catch that tone are naturally not scientists, but they are mystics of the highest sort, of the best kind of sort, the mystics. And so I want to show you how a mystic, a German mystic of the Middle Ages, Meister Eckhart, who lived between 1260 and 1327, therefore still at the before the Renaissance, still in the Middle Ages, but already in that passage from the Dark Ages to the Renaissance, then at that time the German mystics were rather well known. It was a kind of Renaissance for the mystics after the Eastern mystics and the Greek mystics that we had in Europe, these middle-aged mystics, like Meister Eckhart. I just go quickly through a short article which he has written. It is now over 1213, that's now over 600 years ago, and an article on the seven steps of the new man. So he could also perceive that there are seven steps of the new man, and as I read it to you slowly, I don't read the whole article, I just leave out here and there a sentence or part of a sentence which may not be so necessary, and to show you how really he too, like the prophets, could catch the tone of the seven. His first stage is that man lives according to the model of a good and holy man. So you see, he tells us now the sevenfold story in regard to man, just man, how to build up the true man in a creative way. So the very first point is that man has to live according to the model of a good and holy man. If we know the tonality, we know this is mind. Instead of model, you may have said according to the image, or to the, I think the best would be it, according to the image or model of a good man. So the very first thing is that we have a model in view, that we have an image that is ideal. The second step is that he says, man then turns his back to men and turns towards God's face. So can you see the second step? Always separation, turning away from the wrong, turning towards the good. That's always the second step. When one knows the textbook well enough, you can see that Mrs. Eddy uses that turning away from the wrong, turning to the right, over and over hundreds of times, either in the main tone or in the subtone of spirit. It's the second day of the firmament. The third stage he defines like this: man is united to God so that God gives him joy and gladness, and man can no more do evil. It would no more tempt him. You see, a very definite sense of soul, namely that man is sinless, that he is identified with God, man is united to God. We just could say man is identified with God. In which way? That God gives him joy and gladness. You see, the joy of soul, the happiness of joy of soul. And man can do no more evil. He can no more sin. He is now free from sin. He gives the fourth step and says, man roots himself more and more in God. See, now he roots himself. The fourth day I said, and God set the light in the firmament of heaven. He fixed it in the heaven, in its principle. So here too, man roots himself more and more in God. He finds in God his foundation, so that nothing else can move him anymore. You see how wonderful? So that only God is operating in him, that only God moves him. And therefore he is, so to say, the activity of the divine principle. The fifth stage, man lives peacefully in the richness and abundance of the highest unspeakable wisdom. You feel the waters that bring forth abundantly. Man lives peaceful in the richness and abundance of the highest unspeakable wisdom. So he had the sense of life, the abundance of life, the fullness of life. He has a sixth stage. Do I go too fast? Yes. A sixth stage. Man has forgotten his mortal life. You see, he has forgotten erroneous consciousness. He has get rid of erroneous. He has forgotten what he really was as a mortal, and is transformed into the divine image. In the sixth day, man was made in the image of God, in the divine image. When he has become what? The God's child, the Son of God. We have always in the sixth day, man as God's son, the child of God. So here you have a very definite sense of the sixth day of truth. Man has forgotten his mortal life. He does not know anymore himself as a mortal. He has no more consciousness of himself as a mortal being, and is transformed into the divine image when he has become God's child. And then he has a seventh stage. Man has thus entered, what do you think he says? Peace and rest. His final aim is attained. Can you see the seventh day of creation? He has finally reached the aim and found, and so he has found the day of rest, the day of peace. And so, can you see that he, just by listening to the influx of divine inspiration, he could also see an ordered way of understanding a subject. Here the subject is man. How can I understand the subject man? What is the ordered way? And we can see that it is the same irresistible order as we would have in the days of creation. Well, now the question is, did Meister Eckhart know? By the way, do you know what I speak about Meister Eckhart? I think you know him, more or less, or? He spells himself E-C-K-E-H-A-R-T. And Meister means really the master. It's really what the Eastern would say, the guru. Or the Swami, I don't know exactly which one they use, or both. Huh? It's the master mystics. Huh? So Meister Eckhart. So we can ask ourselves, did Meister Eckhart really know that he has stated something as an invariable law? Or has it just felt, that's the way I would understand this subject? We don't know. We don't know. But this would be the great issue. If he has only felt that this is the way that the idea came to him and that he wrote it down the way the idea came to him, then this law would be right, but not a law for him. Only for those who have now found out that it coincides with the days of creation, to them it has become a law which says now this order of development is an irresistible order, an invariable order, and this makes it scientific. This is the great difference. So we should take the opportunity and see that when we have found something in a scientific way, that we say, then we can follow that way through reason, through logic, through divine understanding, and we are no more dependent on revelation. Because we know we may wait for a whole lifetime for a revelation, we never get it. A revelation is something that only comes to a very few so-called chosen ones. Yes. So, if we have considered really that law of creativity in the various time sense, huh? First from the 3 billion years, then to the 1,000-year periods, then to Jesus' life, a small period, then really here to a smaller period of understanding what is man. We can understand that in a shorter time, or may not need a whole lifetime. We begin to see that therefore the time sense in it is not an important element, that it is just the law behind it that is timeless and spaceless, which is of importance. I say that because I want to take up another question that actually would need a lot of time if we would go deeper into it, but I don't want to do that because I don't want to detract the thought from the Bible and the textbook, namely, to a rather modern version of the law of creativity are shown in the days of creation, namely the law of creativity as it is discovered, as it is presented today through the various sciences, say through those sciences that investigate creativity, through the science of creativity. The science of creativity is a very new science of recent year, and therefore we can feel that we are here touching a subject that has perhaps not yet been seen to that extent clearly as we would like to have it. But still, I want to show you a few examples of how today, apart from Christian science, and therefore also apart from the mystics, how through the investigation of the in the academic fields, what constitutes creativity, that these results of these fields come, so to say, to similar conclusions as the biblical writers. So I want to talk a little bit about the creativity and the science of creativity. What is actually creativity? I take a definition which seemed to me very good, and it reads that creativity is something dynamic. Something dynamic. A process which develops and unfolds and which carries already within itself origin and aim. I feel this definition contains practically everything which we need for creativity, that it is first of all dynamic. It is something that flows, that you don't have to push, that it is a flow of ideas. It's a process which develops, therefore it goes through various stages, which unfolds, and which carries already within it what? The origin and the aim. So it is actually a goal causality that is programmed into this law, that it not only contains a right beginning, but that right beginning is already contains already everything that is necessary in order to unfold that right beginning so that we arrive at the set aim. This investigation into creativity is a very new discipline in the academic field. As I said, it is something that has been taken up, if I'm right, in the late 50s, roundabout, well, got more real interest in the 1960s, and then rather developed rather quickly and widely, and has become quite a big subject in the various fields. Also, the whole question of innovation and the science of innovation, and I have to be careful now what I say, because we have in the class somebody who has studied that rather carefully here in America, and has a good knowledge of it, so I have to watch my words, what I'm now going to say. And what I'm going to say is very rudimental compared with what the academic field has now brought out. And I just want to pinpoint it for one sense, not that you go and think that you learn more about Christian science by investigating now these various presentation of creativity and innovation. That's a field all by itself. It's for the academic field. It's of great import there. But what we need, naturally, is the spiritual law of creativity, because our law of creativity is that creativity which brings forth the true man in us. Whereas all the other laws of creativity that the academic field presents to us and the innovation theories are actually all that concerns the thinking method in any subject, in science and art. It isn't so much that it transforms us. But it is interesting to see, and that's why I take it here, it is interesting to see that when an idea has been seen, a spiritual idea has been seen, that this idea always has its impact on civilization, on the human, on every other science. A spiritual idea never stays up in heaven, just in the absolute. It always translates itself to the human and brings forth in the human its identical reproduction that naturally translated to the human level. Therefore, these theories of creativity are reflections of that which has been discovered, so to say, in the 1940s, or perhaps going back to 1938-39, when John Dolly for the first time began to see really that the days of creation are an irresistible law, an invariable law of creation. He never really called it that way. I think I was the first one who felt, I call it the law of achievement. We can start somewhere and come to the point of fulfilled achievement, and then later on we called it the law of creativity. So that we see, first, somebody had to see it in its spiritual realm, like John Dolly, as through the days of creation, and that then afterwards the world began to respond to it.